Hi, everybody.
Hey, Dr. Gatto.
How's it going? Good. Y'all looking forward to the nice quiz we're going to have later tonight? Yeah. It's going to be fun. I wish I could join you, but I already know all the answers. Then without further ado, we'll continue where we left off last time. The Constantinian Revolution. The accession of Constantine to the imperial throne in a way it's in 312, but he doesn't become fully emperor right away. The revolution, let's just put it that way, his Christian revolution doesn't take place until 313. He comes to the throne in 312 in the West. He was the son of Constantius. Now, he was not actually the legitimate successor in the West. Constantius had a different Caesar, but the army wanted Constantine to take his father's place, and they got their way because they got those swords. Okay, so Constantine ended up becoming emperor in the West in 312. But not everyone accepted that, and there were a number of civil wars that had to be fought in order for him to secure that position. Sometimes Constantine is given a little too much credit for the success of Christianity in the Roman Empire. Now, lack of data, obviously, makes accurate statistics difficult to establish, but it's commonly estimated that at the time that he came to power, about 10% of the empire was Christian. I think still that number is even a little high, because there had been a massive extermination just before this. But some people say about 10%. Seems a little high to me. Would almost the entire population of the empire, the other 90%, have eventually embraced the name Christian if Constantine had not converted? Probably not. Alternatively, if Roman society were to have embraced Christianity in some form or other under hostile rulers, it would have taken much longer, like at least 100, 150 years. They were growing, but slowly. So you can attribute to him an acceleration of the process. All right? But I don't know if you want to give him credit for the whole ball of wax. All right. He did make an impressive contribution to Christianity, or, depending on your outlook, maybe he ruined it, but either way, you shouldn't overvalue him or undervalue him. But I'll try and explain to you what exactly he did and what he didn't do. All right, the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. Significant moment in the life of Constantine. His father, as I said, ruled the West, and the great persecution stopped in the West before it did in the East. Ignoring all protocols, Constantine claimed to be emperor because the army wanted him to, but he had to fight against a couple of rivals, and his last great rival in the West was a guy named Maxentius. No one that you need to know for, you know, a test, but Maxentius is who he fought in the battle at the Milvian Bridge. All right. On the eve of the battle, as the story goes, he fought an initial battle and lost it, and he was going to fight again the next day. And he was really worried because he was losing. And it is said, according to the story, okay, that he had a dream that night. And in the dream, he saw a vision of the Cairo, a symbol. Okay, and that's the symbol up there in the upper right. I told you about the Cairo already, right? Symbol of Christ. All right? We call it the labarum, the full symbol with that whole symbol that you see up there. That's called the labarum. Okay? He said that he saw this in a vision and heard the words, "In this conquer." Okay? And he knew that that was a sign that he was supposed to fight in the name of the Christian God. All right? And he swore an oath that they were going to use the labarum on all their battle standards. Okay? And they put the labarum on all the flags, all the battle standards, and they were going to go and march into battle under the Christian symbol. And he was victorious. and defeated Maxentius. And that told him that the Christian God was the true God. That's the story. In later versions, they changed the labarum to the cross, because the cross will become more popular in later literature. I think in Eusebius, he says the Cairo, but in Socrates, he's already got it as the cross. But it probably was the Cairo. Now, what about this conversion? We have to kind of understand Constantine's thinking here. What happened on that day was not so much an ethical turning or embracing of a new belief system or anything like that, right? It's rather the adoption of a symbol, the sign of the Christian God. Remember, in those days, magic loomed very large in popular belief. He faced victory or death. He needed divine favor. He needed good luck. All right? The right ritual or the right symbol might do the trick. And a divine revelation showed him the symbol to use, and it worked. So there's a magical aspect to this. Now, we know that he had this kind of view because a little bit later, his mother, when she went on a trip, she sent him relics from the Holy Land, and he had what's supposed to be wood from the actual cross that Jesus died on, and he took splinters of the wood and embedded it in a statue of himself in Constantinople as a talisman for the protection of the city. So he really believed this stuff. He apparently also took the nails that are said to have been the nails that they nailed into Jesus and made them into bridle bits for his horse and a helmet for use in his military expeditions. So he kind of has a lucky rabbit's foot dimension to Christianity, okay? This is the way he's looking at it. So his concern in becoming a Christian was not so much the salvation of his own soul, but more the well-being of the empire. All right? For him, Christianity was not so much a religion of love or humility or a way of life. It's more like a religion of power. Who's the ruler of the universe? The Christian God. So you have to support the supreme ruler. In some ways, the conversion was clear-cut. His next 25 years as emperor was very consistently in the favoring of Christianity. He did a lot to help Christianity. He had this big triumph after this victory. It was common in Rome to have a big solemn parade in the city to celebrate your victory. And he, during that triumph, he attributed the success to the divinity, he said. He made it ambiguous so the pagan people could get on board, but the divinity, the supreme God. So he seems to have really believed it, all right? Although it is said that he did issue some coins at the time, putting a picture of the sun on the coins and saying the sun god helped him win the victory. Now, did he just do that for the pagans of the empire? Did he really believe that? Is he equating Jesus with the sun? It's unclear. Roman coins will continue to feature the traditional pagan gods for the next couple of years anyway. And then it gets switched to just the sun for another couple of years. And then finally, he does get rid of them. So there's certainly some mixing of religious traditions together in his mind. But he thought of himself as... Well, he had to. The emperor was the Pontifex Maximus. He is the high priest of Rome. So in embracing Christianity, he's going to treat it much the same way as he would the Roman religion. He sees himself as kind of like the leader. And this is the way he's going to approach it. Before Constantine, Christianity did not have any secure place in the law or in society. At the best of times, it was just tolerated. But at the worst of times, you already know what could happen. All right, Constantine changed all of that. Now, in 313, he met with his co-emperor, Licinius. That's the guy who's ruling in the east. In 313, they met at Milan, and they passed what is known as the Edict of Milan, which apparently legalized Christianity officially. Now, whether it was a completely, it initiated this, or actually was just a confirmation of Christian protection, is a matter of debate, but it's kind of the document that everyone looks at as the official legalization of Christianity. They legalized it. Okay? But Christianity is still not the state religion. Keep that in mind. It's not the official religion of the empire or anything like that. They're just, you know, making it legal. Now, did he do anything against paganism during this period? A little. He closed some pagan temples that were already notoriously depraved, so it's not really that big of a deal. He did take some wealth, you know, some riches from some of the temples and use it for other things, but not much other than that. More significant were measures that were not anti-pagan, but simply pro-Christian. So, for example, he gave state significance to Sunday, the Christian day of worship. In 321, he declared the closure of all the courts on the day of the sun, he said, and he also said that you weren't supposed to work on that day. And he also required his soldiers to pray on Sundays to, he said, the supreme God, although not naming Christ. All right. Even more significant was Constantine's early decision to channel state relief to the poor through Christian charitable endeavors. He's going to be giving to the poor through the church. And it kind of is etching into the popular consciousness the idea that the church is a source of help for those who are in need. The church already had a whole system for helping the poor, so it wasn't that hard. All he had to do was give them the money and then tell them who needed it, and then they would do it because they already had the system in place. Another thing that he did was he funded the erection of grand church basilicas. Basilica, does anyone know what a basilica is, what the official definition is? You've heard of the word before, I'm sure. A basilica. It's a new kind of church that doesn't appear to this until this period. They're rectangular buildings, very prestigious. They're used as royal audience halls and law courts. There's business offices in there, a variety of other civic offices. So it's already part of Roman architecture, but it had not been done for Christianity. Now he's making church basilicas. They're Roman-style, large, administrative buildings. Okay, you can worship there too. There's a church as part of it, but it's got all the other stuff too. And he's making them for the Christians. Seven of them were built in Rome alone, the city of Rome. Just to go through kind of how Christian architecture has been developing. We already know that they started out with house churches, right? And then when we get into the time of like Dura Europus and they're starting to convert houses into churches, permanent churches, not just somebody's some place to live, all right? We call that a... These are not terms that you have to remember, but I like to be thorough. A domus ecclesiae. Okay, that's what the Dura Europus church was. It's a two-story building that's been renovated to serve the needs of the church. Then the next step is called a aula ecclesiae, okay, which is a little bit better. And that's simply the same thing, except now you have a very large hall inside of the building. All these words mean is, this means house, this means church, a house of the church, and this is a hall of the church. That just tells you what kind it is. And then the basilica is the third stage. All right? Now they are impressive. Now, these overlap, okay? They're not, you don't just like, okay, we're going to stop making these and we're going to start making those and then we're going to start making those. They're still building all three of them. They overlap. But that's kind of the evolution of the church architecture. Okay? And besides church buildings, he's also going to give them very lavish and precious furnishings. For example, as a result of his gifts, the basilica in Rome, St. Peter's Basilica, had a shrine made for the Apostle Peter out of precious marble and gold. And there was a huge cross of solid gold. There was a silver gilt altar, and it had 400 precious stones on it. And then there was a golden dish to receive the offertory, you know, the contributions. Those are some of the most notable items. This is the kind of stuff that the church is getting now. I mean, they were poor before, and now they can get all kinds of stuff that they never had. All right? Now, that is going to foster the standing of the church in society at large. Now the Romans who are not Christians are going to look at these churches and be like, wow, impressive. You know, I guess there's something to this. But, you know, you can look at it two different ways. Is this contributing to the church or is it harming it? There are Christians at that time with different opinions. Some of them were like, this is awesome, right? And others are like, oh, you're ruining it. You're ruining everything. We're not about that. Here's the thing, though. State favor definitely accelerated conversions to Christianity. Massive amounts of people began converting, all right? Because it was now favored by the state, okay? And there are perks. I'll give you an example here. There's a city called Majuma. It's in the Gaza Strip that was able to win a new and improved charter for the city, okay? All they had to do to get it, they informed Constantine that the city was now completely Christian. Don't know if it was true, but that's what they told him. He gave him the new charter. So you're getting political perks for converting to Christianity. And the congregations were just burgeoning. All right? But again, is it quantity over quality? There were people at the time who thought that it was. Okay? And also, there were problems. Is there going to be a corrupting influence on the church with regard to... Well, let me give you some examples. If people are converting for what they can get out of it, doesn't that suggest that their faith is not true? Okay? Or not as true as the faith of other people? If you converted during a time of persecution, doesn't that say that, you know, you have greater faith in Jesus than if, you know, it's easy to do so and you get all these rewards for doing it? A lot of long-time Christians at the time were complaining of this. All right? Wealthy Roman senators were still kind of holding out in the conversion process. For most of the 4th century, it'll be that way. But near the end of the 4th century, they start coming in. And it's because their wives and families were increasingly adhering to Christianity. And again, the perks were becoming more and more apparent. And there's going to be more perks. We're going to see more of them as time goes on. The church was becoming very quickly a wealthy institution. The bishops began to live in high style. Their senior representatives would actually dine with Constantine. They would often be appointed to be bishops based on their standing in society during these times. Oh, he's a wealthy person. And oftentimes they would get the job. Early in his reign, Constantine declared all Christian clergy exempt from taxes. And they were also exempt from the burdens of public office. You know, you didn't have to go into public office like some people were made to do, even if you were upper class. Now, these are rights that the Roman upper class had previously. He's just giving them to the Christian clergy now. But what does that mean? They're now considered upper class. Okay? They all have all the rights of upper class. If you were on the town council leadership, for example, if you held a position on the town council, you would be in charge of taxes in the region. The rule was, if you didn't collect enough taxes from the people, you had to pay whatever you didn't make. You know, the state's requiring you to give so much. If you didn't make all that from collecting the taxes, it came out of your own pocket. So many of these officials who had these jobs would convert to Christianity because the exemption from taxes applied to that as well. So let's say you collected taxes and didn't have enough. Well, you're exempt from taxes, so you didn't have to pay the whatever else was left. All right? So people were converting to Christianity for reasons like that. This is an interesting story. This is from a little bit later in this century, but there was a rich aristocrat, priest, and he was pagan, and he knew the bishop of Rome. His name was Damasus, and he used to joke with Damasus saying, "Make me bishop of Rome, and I'll become a Christian," suggesting that Damasus was really living high on off the hog. Is it high on the hog or off the hog? Off the hog, I think. Anyway, he had such a great lifestyle, being Bishop of Rome, you know, that even the pagan guy who wasn't even interested in Christianity is like, if I could have your job, I'll become a Christian like that. Okay. Just showing what it was like to be a bishop in Rome in those days. It was great. All right. So things have changed quite a bit, almost overnight. All right, we were talking about Constantine and some of the changes that he made, in particular with regard to Christianity. And I believe I left off, I'm just about to talk about bishops as judicial officers, right? All right, what do I mean by that? If we think back to the Apostle Paul in the first century, we notice that, well, you didn't notice because you didn't read this letter, but in one of his letters, okay, he urges the Christian community at Corinth to use its own wise counselors to arbitrate disputes between Christians, rather than taking those disputes to a secular legal setting. So they're arguing about money or whatever it could be, all right? Better for them to go to some wise counselors in the church to arbitrate than to go outside to court. And the reason being is because then the outsiders see Christians arguing with each other and it doesn't give them a good name. So better do it on the inside. All right? He also probably was concerned about fairness because powerful members of society commonly allowed the rich people to oppress the poor, even in an illegal setting. So maybe Paul didn't want that to happen either. All right? But that became a rule for Christians to follow over the years. Well, Constantine enshrined that into imperial law. Where two Christians were engaged in a legal dispute, either one could have the case transferred from the hearing of a state magistrate. Let's say it was already outside in the courts. If they wanted to, they could transfer it to the arbitration of a bishop. All right? Legally. And what the bishop ruled, that would be legal by state law. Okay? So that's interesting. And that became a system by which the bishops will gain even more power in the empire. Okay? Think about this. We're going to go through the 300s here, and more people are converting to Christianity as a result of the emperor's, you know, programs. When more and more people are Christians, that's going to lead to more and more people having their cases transferred to the bishop's jurisdiction. Because Christians generally will want that. They'll want the bishop to arbitrate. So the bishops are going to be becoming these judges for more and more people as time goes on. We hear a story like in the latter part of the 4th, maybe early part of the 5th century, where Augustine says that every morning he spent adjudicating in lawsuits as the bishop of Hippo, okay, in North Africa. His whole morning was taken up with that because there were so many people that wanted to see him with regard to that. All right, so this was time-consuming, but it also made the bishop very powerful. State involvement in church affairs. I'm sure you saw this coming. Constantine inherited a situation where religion was now very much a state concern. And think about it. State involvement in religious affairs was normal for the Roman Empire. They've been doing it for years. All right? And the emperor himself was the Pontifex Maximus, the high priest of Rome. It was his duty to supervise religious life. So Constantine naturally saw himself as in the same role with regard to the church. He was on a divine mission, okay, to use his political and military power to foster Christianity, to protect Christians. He even tried to do this in Sassanid Persia, sending letters to the Persians saying, be nice to the Christians over there. He felt it was his duty to do that. All right, so naturally, now we're going to see the emperor very much involved in all the things going on in the church. Now, he tries to allow the leaders to do their thing, but he's going to guide them. All right? Well, this leads us to the Donatist Schism. I told you about the Donatist Schism already. When Constantine came to power, there were both Donatist churches and non-Donatist churches, especially in Africa. All right, and in other places as well, but mainly in North Africa. Now, he had to face this problem from a secular point of view. In other words, which church, or maybe both churches, is the state going to favor and support? Can he do both? Should he do just one? And also, another question came up. Does church property confiscated in the Great Persecution belong to the Donatist churches or the non-Donatist churches? All right, who do you give it back to? Because he wanted to give back the land that was taken during the Great Persecution. And the Donatist churches were saying, that was our land, those were our churches, we want that land back. But Constantine has to decide whether he wants to give it back to them or not, or to give it to the mainstream church. Well, he quickly backed the mainstream or Catholic bishop. Be careful when you use the word Catholic here. It's with a small c, okay? Generally, we use the word Catholic during this time period to refer to the mainstream church. All right? As the bishop of Carthage, Caecilian was only able to survive because of the support of Constantine. Nobody really liked him all that much, but Constantine supported him. Also, it had a lot to do with the fact that he was in communion with Rome. Rome had accepted him. All right, and churches in the northern Mediterranean embraced him. So that's why he was granted the right to get this land. All right, but he was also asked to abandon a certain sacramental theology that he had that didn't coincide with the way they did it in the northern Mediterranean. So he changed that so that he could be accepted by Constantine, and that's what Constantine did. Well, immediately Donatus, who is the bishop for the Donatists, he appealed to Constantine. This is in 313. This is right when Constantine came to power here. And Constantine referred the matter to a council of bishops that met in Rome. And those Roman bishops ruled against the Donatists. Then Donatists appealed again. And Constantine referred that to another council, all right, which was kind of a court of appeal. And the appeal council also agreed. They ruled against the Donatists. All right. Complications and more appeals kind of caused the issue to drag on. And in the end, Constantine had had enough. And starting in 317, he began exiling the Donatist leaders. And he also gave an order that all their church property should be confiscated. This led, by the way, to several people, including two Donatist bishops, being killed in a skirmish between the military forces and the Donatist supporters, because they were giving the military a hard time when the military went in there to try to take away their stuff. All right? But dangerous precedents are being set here. All right? From now on, the church is going to routinely expect that the state will enforce the decisions of its councils. These councils met with regard to the Donatists, they gave a certain ruling, and Constantine went along with it and enforced it with the power of the law and the military. So now the church is coming to expect that that's going to happen from now on. And actually it does. All right. The schism completely dominated the African church for the next century. I mean, just because they do this doesn't mean the Donatists are going to give up. All right? They continue to meet and continue to fight for their survival. And they will eventually disappear, but not for... they won't completely disappear until Islam sweeps them away several centuries in the future. Okay? And now we get to another controversy that the state got involved in, and that's the Arian controversy. Arian named after a man called Arius. Arius was a presbyter from Alexandria. Let me give you a little background here. Constantine felt like he needed a unified church because he wanted a united empire. And what better way to unite the empire than having a united church? He didn't like that the church was so fractious. Is that a word? It was broken up into fractions. All right, you get the idea. He didn't like that. There's a lot of disagreement among the church people about whatever beliefs. Okay? So he wanted to get rid of that. Christianity, at this point, still had not come to a consensus about the nature of Jesus, about their Christology. And from Constantine's point of view, he couldn't even understand that. He's like, you guys, Jesus is like your man, right? He's the guy for you. And you still, after all these hundreds of years, don't really know his true nature? What's going on with that? So he felt like they really needed to come to a consensus. And he pushed the issue. All right? When the church still faced the threat of persecution, these issues really weren't that prominent because they were just worried about staying alive. And everyone liked each other then, right? All the Christians were buddy-buddy because they got to support each other during the persecution. But when the persecution went away, then they start fighting, okay? Because they got nothing to unite them anymore, and they're arguing about their differences. And that's immediately what happened. As soon as the great persecution ended, they start battling it out about their beliefs, particularly their Christology. Now, it's funny, even though Constantine will try to make every effort to unite them on their Christology, he does not solve the problem, and for the next 150 years, they're going to be still hashing it out. Okay? But he gets the ball rolling. Prior to Constantine, the church didn't have any way of enforcing its decisions. So even if they had a council, and they got a bunch of bishops there, and all the bishops said, this is what we're going to believe, they'd have no way to make other people believe that. All right? But now, they do. Now they can have a council, make a decision, and the emperor will enforce it. So this is why things begin to change. They have much stronger coercive strength. But it has to be not just the emperor who does it. They have to try to find some kind of substantial church consensus. If you just have a couple of bishops say, okay, this is what we're going to believe, what are all the other bishops going to do? You got to get some kind of consensus along with the enforcement, or else it won't work. Now, on this idea of Constantine, or the emperor in general, being the Pontifex Maximus, it would be natural for him to get involved in church affairs, but this influence could be significant in several ways. First of all, the emperor could bring issues to a head by instigating the holding of a council. He could say, hey, I want you to have a council. And this is what Constantine will do with the Council of Nicaea, which we're getting to. Second, the moral influence of the emperor might lead the church to decide one way rather than another. And it doesn't happen with this council, but in a couple later councils it will. In other words, the emperor kind of pushes for a certain decision and will get his way. And third, the emperor could take direct measures to enforce the decisions of the councils. And they will do that from here on in. And by the way, we're going to see many, many councils throughout the next century and a half. Some of them the emperor supports and some of them he doesn't. Whatever ones he goes with, those are the ones that get their way. The ones that he doesn't go with, they meet, they decide, nothing happens. What we will see as a result of all this is a decline in innovative theology. People aren't getting creative anymore when it comes to theology. We saw like during the period of speculation, the early 200s, people like Origen and Clement of Alexandria, they're thinking of all these kind of cool new ideas. There's going to be a decline in that way of thinking because people are going to be afraid to think outside the box. You got to go along with the majority. So there's going to be a decline in adventurous theology. All right? The stage is basically being set for what will later be medieval scholastic theology. All that was defending what was already known rather than coming up with something new. Okay? But it's going to be very divisive in these early days. And the Arian debate is what starts it all going here. Some people think that Arius caused the whole thing. He doesn't really. He's just a symptom. He's not the cause. He just reflects a certain understanding that some people had. All right? But he had the kind of personality where he really wanted to promote it and push it, and that's what's going to cause problems. Okay? Because people held his theology, but they just kept it to themselves, and it was their personal belief. You know, they have maybe friends who believe the same way, but he's going to try and push it. And that's kind of what starts it, the whole thing going. All right, very few of his writings are preserved, actually, suggesting either that his later followers didn't really value them that much, or that they were destroyed by enemies. Whatever the case, we don't have that much from Arius. In fact, most people who were labeled Arians denied that they followed Arius. They may have agreed with Arius, but they're like, he's not our leader. But I told you that's kind of what people do. When they don't like a certain heresy, they don't like certain beliefs, they label them followers of some guy. Oh, you're a such and such. And of course, they're going to deny it and say, no, we're Christians. You're Arians. All right. That's just the way it worked. Okay, so Arius really was not that important to Arians, the people who held his belief. He was more important to the enemy. Okay? But here's how it all went down. Again, fundamental to the issue here is the divinity of Jesus. Most Christians by this time believed in the preexistence of Jesus. In other words, that he existed as a spirit prior to his birth as a human being. All right? The adoptionist view has been disappearing over the years. Paul of Samosata was the last really great adoptionist. There are some people that still hold that, but it isn't a prevalent view by this time. Now, the problem is in the calling of Jesus God. I told you this before. How is it that Jesus is God? Even Arius agreed that Jesus was God in some way. But in the Greco-Roman world, the word God, all right, Latin deus, Greek theos, had various shades of meaning. There could be lower grades of gods, even human beings that could embody something divine. All right? The question is, how divine is Jesus? And what do I mean by divine? Well, the controversy seems to have erupted around the year 320 in Alexandria. At the center of the controversy is Arius and Alexander. Alexander was the bishop of Alexandria. He was very well loved by the Alexandrians. They actually called him Pope. He's actually the first to have the name Pope, even before the Bishop of Rome. It doesn't mean he's the leader of the church of the whole Mediterranean. The word Pope just means Papa, okay? It's like a reverential title. And it was applied to him in an affectionate way. But anyway, Alexander was the bishop there. And Arius was a presbyter underneath him. Arius was assigned to a certain congregation or church in Alexandria. And he was the presbyter there. He was the leader of that church under Alexander. According to the descriptions we get of him in the sources, he was an unusually tall man. He wore a short cloak and a, what they call a dalmatic, which is a long, wide-sleeved tunic. And he had a very pleasant way of speaking. What we do know is that he was already an old man when this controversy erupted. Now, around this time, it came to the attention of Alexander that Arius was publishing a doctrine that some other presbyters in Alexandria did not like. But then again, there were some others in positions of authority that did agree with him. So there's a difference of opinion. So Alexander immediately sent for Arius, questioned him on the matter. Arius explained his position and defended it. And this is what Socrates says about that point of the argument. He says, Alexander, in the fearless exercise of his functions for the instruction and government of the church, attempted one day in the presence of the presbytery and the rest of the clergy to explain with perhaps too philosophical minuteness that great theological mystery, the unity of the Holy Trinity. Remember, Socrates is speaking from later times when they've got the Trinity all worked out. A certain one of the presbyters under his jurisdiction, whose name was Arius, possessed of no inconsiderable logical acumen, imagining that the bishop was subtly teaching the same view of the subject as Sabellius the Libyan, that's modalism, right? from love of controversy, took the opposite opinion to that of the Libyan, and as he thought, vigorously responded to what was said by the bishop. "If," said he, "the Father begat the Son, he that was begotten had a beginning of existence. And from this it is evident that there was a time when the Son was not." In other words, a time when he did not exist. "It therefore necessarily follows that he had his substance from nothing." Actually, the word substance is hypostasis. He had his hypostasis from nothing. In other words, if the Son was begotten, that means he had to have a beginning. All right? He's disagreeing with Origen, who believed in the eternal generation of the Son. He says there's a time when he did not exist. The Father became a Father to a Son in time. And therefore, just like God created everything else out of nothing, he created the Son out of nothing. Arius is taking begotten to mean created. Okay? That was what caused all the problem. But Alexander, because the issue was so sensitive and he didn't want to get into a big fight, let the matter lie. But the force of the controversy only intensified, and Alexander then called a meeting of the presbytery, and he presided as a judge over the affair, and he asked for statements of faith from both sides. And another historian, Sozomen, who you did not read, says this about that meeting. "It happened on this occasion, as is generally the case in a strife of words, that each party claimed the victory. The council was convened a second time and the same points contested, but they came to no agreement amongst themselves. During the debate, Alexander seemed to incline first to one party and then to the other. Finally, however, he declared himself in favor of those who affirmed that the Son was homoousios and co-eternal with the Father. And he commanded Arius to receive this doctrine and to reject his former opinions. Arius, however, would not be persuaded to compliance, and many of the bishops and clergy considered his statement of doctrine to be correct." But at that point, Alexander stripped Arius of his clerical office. He ejected him from the presbytery. Well, Arius, he was a fighter. He wasn't going to let this go. And he did his utmost to turn the tables. He began a massive letter-writing campaign to all the bishops everywhere, especially in the area of Egypt and Libya and in Syria and Palestine. And he tried to find support, which he did find. And letters began flooding into Alexander, urging him to reconsider his position and allow Arius back into the presbytery. Among those who wrote letters was a fellow by the name of Eusebius of Nicomedia. Dropping down that fourth guy there. I didn't want you to get confused because there are two Eusebiuses. Eusebii, okay? There's Eusebius of Caesarea. That's Eusebius Pamphilus. He's the writer of the church history you read. Okay? He's the bishop of Caesarea. All right? In Palestine. Eusebius of Nicomedia is a different Eusebius. All right? And he's from Nicomedia, which is in Asia Minor. He's one of the supporters of Arius during this period. Actually, both Eusebiuses are supporters of Arius. Okay? During this period. They both write letters on his behalf. Now, they have a little bit different way of going about it. Eusebius of Nicomedia tries to argue with Alexander that he's wrong about his theology. Okay? And he tells him that this word homoousios should be rejected. Eusebius of Caesarea has a different approach. He says, let's not argue. Let's not fight. Okay? There's no point in it. It's just these subtle details. Who cares? All right? We need to be showing Christian love toward one another and be united. This is not important. How can we ever know that, you know, what happened when in the far distant past? It really doesn't matter. So that was his approach. But if you asked him personally, you know, what do you believe? Okay? He sides with Arius. Alexander didn't take kindly to Arius' undermining of his authority by appealing to these other bishops, so his hostility toward Arius just continued to increase. All right? And that finally culminated in a hearing which resulted in the excommunication of Arius from the church, at least in Egypt. Okay, and Arius was banished from Alexandria. He actually left, and he ended up residing with Eusebius of Caesarea for a while, and he also went and lived with Eusebius of Nicomedia for a while. So he found friends that would allow him to go to church there. Okay, but he wasn't allowed back at Alexandria. All right. Now, who is this Athanasius guy? He is Alexander's archdeacon. And he will end up being Alexander's successor. All right. Often, I told you this already, often archdeacons would become the next bishop. Which is interesting. Why not a presbyter? But that's the way they were doing it. Athanasius actually knew a lot more about theology than Alexander. Alexander really wasn't into all the theology, and he wasn't the best debater. But Athanasius, he was awesome at it, okay? And he was really kind of the brains behind that whole position that accepted homoousios and believed in the eternal generation of the Son. Well, he once set down the contents of a work that Arius had written, and this is actually our only source for Arius' work. It's called The Banquet. And he quotes from it in one of, Athanasius quotes from it in one of his works, actually in a couple of his works. And he quotes Arius as saying a number of interesting things, and it helps us to appreciate or understand Arius' position. Arius says things like, "We praise God as without beginning because of him who has a beginning." In other words, Jesus. "We praise God as without beginning because of the Christ who has a beginning." He says, "The Son has nothing proper to God in his substantial nature because he is not equal nor homoousios with him." Okay? And then he says, "There is a triad, but not in equal glories. The Father is foreign in substance from the Son." Okay? "Being Son, he really existed at the will of the Father. God was not always a father, but afterwards he became a father. The Son had an origin of creation. The Logos is not the God, though he is called God, yet he is not very God." They use this word, it comes out in English as very, but they use it to distinguish who's really God. Okay, very God. "But only by participation of grace. He is God in name only." And this is the important point here. So he's saying Jesus is God, but that's just a name. Okay? He's not really the true God. That's Arius' position. Okay? Now, a major concern for the party on Arius' side is they believe that this homoousios is really nothing more than modalism. If you're saying that the Father and the Son are the same substance, you're saying they're the same being, that's modalism. And they didn't like it. But, of course, the other party would deny that. Now, a major concern for the Athanasius side and Alexander's side is the denial that the Son was of the same substance as the Father, homoousios, and the denial of the eternal generation of the Son. They did not like it that Arius said that the Son had a beginning. Okay? And Athanasius, who was much more clever than Alexander, already began writing tracts to say how Arius was wrong. Okay? Now, this dispute operated in a really subtle and rarefied atmosphere where, you know, it would be almost incomprehensible to many Christians today. Like, what? Huh? What are you talking about? And you know, when you read some of their works, like Athanasius' works against the Arians, you're like, man, you know, how is any of this really of any significance? And it's hard to follow sometimes. But it wasn't small and insignificant at the time because they believed this is about the fundamental nature of God. And they thought salvation was at stake here. All right? Sometimes because there was such a fineness in the distinctions between words, people would get upset with other people's statements, but they might have been interpreting it the wrong way. They didn't understand even what they were saying. Even at the time, they might not understand what they were saying. They use the word homoousios. They're not even sure exactly what that might mean. Okay? They use the word hypostasis. They might not be exactly sure what they meant by that. Okay? Socrates, if you recall, says this, "It seemed not unlike a contest in the dark, for neither party appeared to understand distinctly the grounds on which they slandered one another." Okay? And this is funny. About a generation later, there's a Bishop Gregory of Nyssa, and he gave a kind of a witty description of the situation at the time. And he says, if in the city you ask anyone for change, like you got change for a five or whatever, he will discuss with you whether the son is begotten or unbegotten. If you ask about the quality of the bread, you will receive the answer that the father is greater, the son is less. If you suggest that a bath is desirable, you'll be told that there was nothing before the sun was created. In other words, everybody was talking about it and arguing about it. It was like all over the place. So it's not just a matter that the bishops were discussing. All Christians were kind of getting on the bandwagon and wondering what it was all about and trying to figure out what everyone's position was, and they were arguing about these things. All right? Well, it got out of hand. And Constantine sent a fellow from Spain. This guy's name was Osius. No one you need to remember for a test. And Osius was sent to kind of try to calm everybody down. Osius came from Cordoba, which was in Spain. And he favored the position of Alexander and Athanasius. He came there. And he presided over a council at which 59 bishops attended. All right, it was held at Antioch in Syria in early 325. This is before the Council of Nicaea. It's kind of a forerunner of this bigger council. And they issued, and this is kind of, they set a precedent here. They issued a creed, a creedal statement saying, this is what we believe about Jesus. Okay, it's actually going to resemble very much the belief of Alexander and Athanasius. Okay, three bishops at that Council of Antioch refused to sign the creed. One of them was Eusebius of Caesarea, and he was excommunicated, at least provisionally, at this council. And so were the other two, actually. A lot of people think that Osius already knew that the Council of Nicaea was coming up. And by holding this council and excommunicating three bishops, when those three bishops came to the big Council of Nicaea, they wouldn't have much of a voice because they were excommunicated, and so people would not pay as much attention to them. Had they been in good standing when they came to the Council of Nicaea, they may have had freer voice and people may have listened to them more. But whatever the case, Eusebius of Caesarea was excommunicated. Provisionally, Osius told them, all three of them, listen, come to the Council of Nicaea, and if you abide by what the bishops say there, then we'll let you back in. Okay. So the Council of Nicaea. Constantine called it together. It was his idea. He even arranged public conveyance so that the bishops could attend, and he provided for all their expenses. It was well attended by all the major sees, a see is a bishopric, of the eastern side of the empire. Not a whole lot of western bishops came, but there were some. Because of old age, Sylvester, the bishop of Rome, did not attend, but he did send a couple of deacons in his place. The total number of bishops there, in different sources they give different numbers. Some say 318, others say 300, some say 250. Most scholars today say the number was about 220. Whatever the case, probably between 200 and 300 bishops that came. The minutes of the council and the proceedings, they're not in existence anymore. But we know from the writings of Rufinus that daily sessions were held, and that Arius was often summoned before the assembly. Now, he's not one of the bishops. He's only a presbyter. Well, he's an excommunicated presbyter, but they wanted to hear his arguments. So they brought him in, heard what he had to say, and then they would talk about it. All right. Now, attempts were made to construct a creed using only terms drawn from the Bible, from the New Testament. But whenever they made a creed out like that, the people who agreed with Arius said, yeah, we believe that. We're good with it. And the people who sided with Athanasius and Alexander, and Athanasius was there, by the way, even though he wasn't a bishop, didn't like that they thought it was okay. They wanted to have a creed that could exclude their belief. All right? So the idea was, we've got to add something in here that's going to exclude Arius' opinion. All right? And it was decided that the best word to use was the word homoousios, which they already had, you know, thought was good. But when they introduced that word, a number of the bishops balked at it because they're like, well, that's not from Scripture. Like, well, but they're saying, well, it explains Scripture. All right? It's just describing what we find in Scripture in more explicit terms. Well, they were able to sell it. And that's when they formed the Nicene Creed. And remember, homoousios means of the same substance or the same being. Or you will often see it translated in English as consubstantial. That means of the same substance. Okay? The Son and the Father are homoousios. When the creed was finished, 18 bishops still did not want to sign it. Now, Constantine at this point intervened to threaten exile to anyone who would not sign for it. And after a few days of thinking about it, more signed, including at this point Eusebius of Caesarea, who really didn't want to lose his position. All right? There were still two bishops from Libya that refused to accept the creed, and they, along with Arius, were exiled. Now, if you look at the creed in Socrates, all right, you'll see that at the end of the creed, there's actually, I hope it's in Socrates' version, because sometimes you see a shorter version, it'll actually have in there a statement. And if anyone says there was a time when the sun didn't exist, or that the sun was created out of nothing, let him be anathema. You know what anathema is? What does anathema mean? It's a great word. You should use it more often. It's simply something to be rejected. Something that we're going to hate. Okay? Something you stay away from, you reject, you don't want, you don't like. Anathema. A short time later, now this is interesting, Eusebius of Nicomedia was at the council, and he actually argued for Arius' position very strongly, but at the end, he finally signed, because he didn't want to lose his position. He had a different strategy. Sign now, then you can work against it later, which is what he did. So Eusebius of Nicomedia, a few months after the council, began to try to undermine it, and was arguing with people about it again. And when it was found out, he got exiled. So it actually didn't work. Now, he'll make a comeback, though. He continually was in discussion with Arius, even though Arius had been banished, and people didn't like that. Well, did this solve the problems? It seemed to be more of a papering over the cracks, because controversy flared up again after the council was over, when an anti-homoousian position apparently started gaining the upper hand. Now, there are a number of reasons why it failed to get a consensus. Even though at the council there seemed to have been a consensus, ultimately there was not a consensus. All right. First of all, the gathering at Nicaea was subject too strongly to the dominance of the emperor. He's like saying,
you better sign or else.
You know, what are you going to do? Right? Another thing is, the term was not taken from scriptures, and a lot of people didn't like that. Also, there were still quite a number of people who held that the Son was somehow subordinate to the Father. They might have different views about how the Son was subordinate to the Father, but not equal. And so they didn't like the term because of that. Apart from Athanasius, almost every theologian, East and West, did accept some form of subordinationism with regard to Jesus. Okay? Most Christians who were not at the council had probably never even heard of the word before. And, you know, then they're like, what does that mean? And they want to know what it's all about, and people had a hard time explaining it. And still, even though it is a word that kind of narrows things down, it's a word that not everyone interpreted the same way. It's open to diverse interpretation. In fact, when you read Eusebius of Caesarea's letter to his church after the council, he's trying to, like, he didn't like signing. He didn't like the word. But he's trying to write to his church and explain to them why he accepted it. Because clearly from the tone of his letter, and this is preserved in Socrates, from the tone of his letter, his church was behind him, and they're like, go fight for us, and we're behind you, we're behind your beliefs and all that, okay? And so he went, and then he compromised. And so now he has to try to explain it to them, like, why he accepted homoousios. And he gives this explanation of homoousios in his letter that clearly is not what Alexander or Athanasius meant by the word homoousios, but he wants to interpret it in a way that he can accept, okay? And that's kind of interesting to read, but it shows that the word can be taken different ways. All right. Also, people thought that homoousios was just too Sabellian sounding, too modalist sounding, and that's another reason why they didn't like it. Okay. In fact, some of the people who were in favor of homoousios were even saying that the Father and the Son were the same hypostasis, and that was really Sabellian sounding. Okay. So people didn't like that either. Now, when Alexander died in 327, Athanasius succeeded him as bishop, even though he didn't meet the age requirement. He was still quite young. Eusebius of Nicomedia wrote a very diplomatic letter to Constantine saying, I really, want to do what's right, and all about how he loves the church and he's going to support the church and so on and so forth. And he got into good graces with the emperor, and the emperor reinstated him to his bishopric. But he began promoting a non-Nicene, an anti-homoousian theology. He did this by assisting anybody who held the same view as him. Okay? In other words, if he could promote anyone in the church that held a quote-unquote Arian theology, he would. And he'd keep down anyone that he could who held a Nicene theology. One of the things he did was he was able to get Arius reinstated. Arius had taken refuge in Palestine, but he was permitted to return. And Arius, he had to write out a creed of what he believed. I believe this. And he watered down his own beliefs so that he could get back into the church. People like Philostorgius hated Arius for that because Philostorgius loved the old Arius, the one that fought. And this new Arius is like giving in and compromising. He's not happy about Philostorgius. But anyway, Arius was able to get reinstated. More on that in a second. But a couple other things that Eusebius of Nicomedia did. There was a staunch supporter of the Nicene theology and a good friend of Athanasius, who was the bishop of Antioch. He was deposed by Eusebius of Nicomedia. Eusebius of Nicomedia didn't have the power to depose him, but he accused him of some other wrongs so that he could get him deposed. All right, get rid of this Nicaea promoter, and we'll get somebody else in there. And he managed to arrange that. Another partisan of the Nicene Christology, the guy who was the bishop of Ankara, he also got him deposed. He was accused of Sabellianism and, in fact, seemed to be very modalist and got rid of him because of that. So you can see what he's doing now. He's trying to get rid of people that would be promoting Nicaea. He also turned against Athanasius. What happened was, Constantine told Athanasius, this is what Eusebius of Nicomedia wanted, Constantine told Athanasius, you must accept Arius back into communion in Alexandria. And Athanasius said, no way. He refused. So Constantine exiled Athanasius and removed him as bishop of Alexandria. Then Constantine directed another guy, the bishop of Constantinople, and I don't mean to confuse you, but his name happens to be Alexander as well. But anyway, this guy, the Bishop of Constantinople, was made to receive Arius into communion. Now, he objected too, and he was a friend of Athanasius, but he didn't want to be exiled. So he's like, fine. And then we get to this interesting story. It's the day that Arius is supposed to be readmitted into communion. All right, he's at Constantinople, and here's how Socrates describes it. Going out of the imperial palace, attended by a crowd of Eusebian partisans, like guards, he paraded proudly through the midst of the city, attracting the notice of all the people. As he approached the place called Constantine's Forum, where the Column of Porphyry is erected, a terror arising from the remorse of conscience seized Arius. Now, of course, he's putting his own interpretation on this because he doesn't like him. And with the terror, a violent relaxation of the bowels. He therefore inquired whether there was a convenient place near, and being directed to the back of Constantine's Forum, he hastened thither. What happened was, he had to go to the bathroom, right? So, he goes into the bathroom. And as he describes it here, he had some kind of hemorrhage where all of his bowels came out. All right? And he died. People were like, boy, he's taking a long time in there. And they went in to check him. And there he was, dead. Okay? Now, the way that the enemies of Arius portrayed the story was, God struck him down and didn't want him back into communion with the church. But others are like, isn't it kind of a coincidence that on the very day that he was supposed to go back into the church, he's heading to go take communion, suddenly he gets sick, goes into the bathroom, and dies. How awfully convenient, right? So there were accusations that he was poisoned by someone, although nobody knows who.